Blog Talk Radio. Alright, no sound. No sound. Why no sound? Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? I don't know why no sound, because I've got sound over here. Alright, God bless America. God bless America. Let's start this show all over again, because I had something important I wanted to say. Let's play the theme song. One more time. Here we go.
Break myself in the American flag. Never give up the freedom my pop fought for us to have. Never give it back. Same with the gas. You can never take that. Never take that. I'm trying to take my country.
August 2nd, 2011, beautiful Washington, D.C., the United States of America, planet Earth, third planet from the sun. Can you hear me now? Hey, listen, those are the boys from Omega Sci-Fi out of William and Mary in the University of Virginia, my son's fraternity. I myself pledged Alpha. My son decided to go in a different direction. But hey, he's a United States Marine officer. And I'll take that, and he can do his own thing with the fraternity. Anyway, those are the boys from Omega Psi Phi doing the darn thing with the anti-Obama rapping song. All right, I hope that I can be heard here, because I'd like to go ahead and talk a little bit about this whole debt deal. You know, when Obama signed his health care deal in the law, he had media all around. He had doctors, he had lawyers, he had Indian chiefs, he had quite a few folks. He had a cute little boy, little black boy there, little mascot, I guess, handing him the pens, or he was handing the kid the pens. I'm not sure which one it was, but you know, lights were flashing, flash bulbs clicking, you know, a lot of fanfare, a lot of pomp and circumstance. But signing this debt ceiling deal was done behind closed doors. No fanfare, no signing ceremony, no nothing. It was all just very hush-hush. And that's unfortunate. The Treasury today won a big reprieve of $400 billion in new borrowing authority. And the Senate gave final approval to a hotly contested debate and deficit reduction agreement handed out with the White House on Sunday night. The bipartisan roll was 74-26 roll call following a 269-161 vote in the House. It's a big deal. It's all done. Now the Obama administration wants Congress to come back and increase the unemployment benefits. Yeah, the unemployment benefits. So some folks might be getting some extra cash, another 99 weeks or 150 weeks or, you know, roughly, I don't know. But hey, that's what the president wants these guys to work on when they get back. And it's all very interesting stuff. We have a couple of callers on the line. We'll get to you guys in just a minute. I'd just like to go ahead and take a few minutes and talk about, in our first segment here, the indoctrination. The indoctrination of Barack Obama. Now, how did Barack Obama become the leader of a nation whose power he seems determined to diminish? Well, that's an age-old, that's the question we're asking. A lot of us are asking that question. How did Barack Obama become the leader of a nation whose power he seems determined to diminish? Some assume that he must not have known what he was doing. A lot of us say that. I've said it a few times. But that he was carried along by inexperience and naivete. Carried along and into embracing policies that were disastrous for the nation and the world. But hey, this view is at odds with the assessment of his political rivals and colleagues. I've read books, The Manchurian President, The Case Against Barack Obama, and so on. I'm a native of Chicago. I know in which the circles Barack Obama traveled. I was in Chicago at the time he ran for the Senate and won, ultimately against Alan Keyes, who was brought in out of Maryland, I believe, to run against Obama at the very last minute. But the assessment of his political rivals and colleagues, who during the 2008 presidential campaign increasingly regarded him, according to a July 2008 New Yorker profile, as a pure, quote, pure political animal. All right, Craig, got it. A pure political animal. That's what he was listed as. After Obama outfoxed Hillary Clinton and then John McCain on the issues of campaign finance reform, and all sorts of other areas, commentators abruptly stopped using the word callow and naive. But the key to Obama's policies and activities as president lies in his beliefs, in the beliefs and assumptions that he began to absorb in his earliest upbringing, often in associations and events that he's done his best to obscure. But we're going to explore those. Before understanding why Obama does what he does, it's important to review his schooling, his parents, his social mores, his political beliefs, his gurus, his mentors, his friends, his associates. Essentially, these things are what made Obama what he is, as is the case with all of us. The unique and singular beauty of America is that we're not a single race, creed, or color. Ours is a shared value system, a lot of individualism, property rights, intellectual property rights, freedom of speech and religion, and the right to assemble. We are wet nursed on such basic, unalienable human freedoms. Indeed, Americans are hardwired for freedom. We are. All of us are. From birth, we're taught that we are free. The whole slavery issue aside, you know, all of that. But right now, we're hardwired for freedom. We assume these freedoms, like we assume the very air we breathe. No other country can say such a thing. None, mind you. This is what makes America exceptional and historic, an historic anomaly, blessed and gifted. This is how this great country was built. But Barack Obama was not built this way, folks. He did not grow up this way. And since America is not an ethnicity, but a value system, in order to be American, in order to get America, one has to have grown up in America and to have soaked in the idea of living free, growing up under the righteous glow, indeed, of the Declaration of Independence and our great Constitution. This is neither tribal, nor is it collective. It is a singular and individual America. America is the place where one man is not at the mercy of mob rule or minority plotting. Indeed, but Barack Hussein Obama wasn't always Barack Hussein Obama. From 1967 to 1971, he was Barry Sartorial. That's right. An elementary school student in Jakarta, Indonesia, Barack Hussein Obama spent four of his critical formative years from the age of 6 to 10 outside the United States in the largest Muslim country in the world. His father was a Muslim from Kenya, his stepfather a Muslim from Indonesia. Even when he moved to the United States, he came to a place that was far from the American heartland, both geographically and culturally. The place was called Hawaii, one of my favorite places. Now, according to the Chicago Tribune, he had become a state, a state only 2 years before Obama's birth, Hawaii. And there was plenty of native Hawaiians still deeply unhappy about that. The arc of Obama's personal journey took him far off places, and situations far removed from the experience of most Americans. Now, while Indonesia also, Obama's family lived as Indonesians lived. Much later, he recalled that the family lived what in America would have been considered a life of poverty. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He went on to say, and I quote, "We lived in a modest house on the outskirts of town without air conditioning, refrigeration, or flush toilets. We had no car. My stepfather rode a motorcycle while my mother took the local jitney service." Yeah. Uh-huh. So, Obama really... His mother, well, honestly, his mom took the local jitney service to the every morning to the U.S. Embassy. So she rode a taxi, pretty much, where she worked as an English teacher. Without the money to go to the international school that most children attended, he went on to say, "I went to a local Indonesian school and ran the streets with the children of farmers, servants, tailors, and clerks." Aww. Then he was also born in a manger. He left that part out. The future president recalled a decidedly Indonesian childhood, saying he spent his days chasing down chickens and running from water buffalo. Well, who of us did not? He recounted much later, and I quote, "When I think of Bali and all of Indonesia, I'm haunted by memories. The feel of packed mud under bare feet as I wandered through paddy fields. The sight of day breaking behind volcanic peaks." Aww, how romantic. Very cozy. Very, very. I mean, who doesn't like mud between their toes? Come on, somebody, anybody. Who doesn't like it? I dig it. I tell you what, I put myself out there. I love a little mud between my toes. Hey, look, I'm just trying to keep it real. All right, so occasionally his mother would take him to the American Club where he'd jump in the pool and watch cartoons and sip Coca-Cola. He said, to his heart's content. Obama said in his second autobiography, The Audacity of Hope, that he knew that he and his mother were citizens of the United States, beneficiaries of its power, safe and secure under the blanket of its protection. That's nice. And yet his mother appeared dedicated to undermining that power and stripping American citizens of that safety and security. For Barack Obama's mother, Stanley Ann Durham, was a communist. Yeah, his mama was a communist. Now let me tell you. Let me get sidetracked here for a minute. You know, when I told my mom, as a young child, I told my mom that I was a Republican. You know what my mom said to me? She snapped at me. My mom snapped at me, and she said, "We are Democrats." And I said, okay, I'm a Democrat. And that's all I knew. I was a Democrat. Until I grew up and began to understand what it meant to be a Democrat, and I didn't like it at all. All right. So his mom was a communist. Now, everything that I'm telling you has been thoroughly researched, and you can find it anywhere on the net. So please remember that when I speak this way, I'm giving you the facts that have been researched over and over and over again. Never let it be said that I provided any of my listeners with false information. When I'm staking my opinion, I will announce this is my opinion. But other than that, if I do not announce that in advance or shortly thereafter the sentence is finished, I'm giving you hard, cold facts. So now, Stanley was a communist, and she moved in communist circles and had communist friends. Her parents put her in a high school run by a self-proclaimed communist who had been hauled before the House Un-American Activities Committee. A high school friend described her as a, quote, fellow traveler, end quote. Does anybody know what that means? Yeah, communist. And in both high school and college, she moved in the most radical circles in her area. Now, here's the thing. Before we get into more of this, I'd like to take a short break, and then we'll come right back, and then we'll get more into what's happening here, because I'd really want to get into this.
Lights, camera, action. You've been enjoying yourself, but now it's time to make them love you again. You're cool, calm, collected. You've always gotten what you wanted. But was it ever what we wanted? We need jobs. We need leadership. Yet you do nothing as we pile up debts we can't afford. It's like you don't even get it.
And I'm one of your middle-class Americans. And quite frankly, I'm exhausted. I'm exhausted of defending you, defending your administration, right, defending the mantle of change that I voted for.
We hope. And you hope.
My hope is...
But hope isn't hiring.
Why is Ayn Rand's great novel Atlas Shrugged a bestseller today, more than half a century after it was written? It's because our real world today is just like the fictional future that Rand foresaw in Atlas Shrugged. It's a time of crisis and decay, but it's also a world of innovation and achievement. It's a world of heroes and villains, driven by very different philosophies. We wrote I Am John Galt to tell their stories. We look at the heroic innovators who are building our world and show that they're doing it just like the heroes of Ayn Rand's novels. They're using her philosophy of capitalism, reason, objective reality, and self-interest. Who is John Galt? Meet John Allison, the mild-mannered Southerner who created one of America's greatest banking empires. He did it with Ayn Rand's philosophy by getting every one of his tens of thousands of employees to read Atlas Shrugged and live by its code. In the great financial crisis of 2008, his bank was about the only one that didn't need a government bailout. But the government forced Allison to take TARP money anyway. After that, Allison walked away, just like John Galt did. There's so many other Rand heroes in our midst. There's Bill Gates, the genius who built the world's greatest company and the world's greatest personal fortune, only to have his own government call him a criminal for succeeding too much. Isn't he just like Hank Reardon from Atlas Shrugged? And how about Steve Jobs, the brilliant entrepreneur who reinvented computers, movies, music, telephones, just because he thought it was so cool? He's got the same attitude toward life as Howard Roark from Rand's other great novel, The Fountainhead. Build it? I don't care if they come. You'll meet some real-life Rand villains in our book, too, the parasites who are trying to destroy the world. Remember Wesley Mooch from Atlas Shrugged, the corrupt bureaucrat who destroyed the economy? That's Congressman Barney Frank, who spent years subsidizing Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in the name of altruism. When Fannie and Freddie nearly wrecked the U.S. housing market, what did Frank do? Just like Mooch, he demanded wider powers. And you'll meet Paul Krugman, the rabid partisan pundit who spreads socialism from the pages of the New York Times and thinks nothing of using the power of the press to destroy his political enemies. He's Ellsworth Toohey, the scheming, dwarfish newspaper columnist straight from the pages of The Fountainhead. These are some of the heroes and villains who move our world. So who is John Galt? I am. You can be too. Read our book and find out how.
All right, we're back with the C. Robert Jones Conservative Report. Hey, listen, the call-in number is 347-884-8500. Please do get your copy of I Am John Galt. It is a great read. If you liked Atlas Shrugged, if you love The Fountainhead, and if you dig The Fountainhead movie from the 50s, you will love I Am John Galt. And next week, we're going to be featuring a lot of John Galt's. I Am John Galt. Folks who produce, folks who manufacture, people who build things, people who employ other people who are being overtaxed, entrepreneurs who are being overregulated, and who are considering moving their businesses out of the United States of America to seek some sort of shelter or redress for the overburdening tax and regulations this country is imposing upon them. The reason why companies are not hiring is not because they don't need the help. It's because this administration has scared folks into not hiring. Nobody knows what's going to happen. What's the tax situation going to look like? How's this Obamacare situation going to affect everything? Nobody really knows. Folks are sitting on their hands. They're sitting on their money. They don't know what to do. It's as if big business, small business, is paralyzed with fear of this administration. And folks are seeking shelter in countries that are much more tax and regulation friendly in order to make a profit and to produce and be productive entrepreneurs. So if you love that sort of thing, if you're all about that, if you're even marginally about that, you'll love I Am John Galt. And hey, your host here, C. Robert Jones, I Am John Galt too. Okay, so check it out. I Am John Galt. Now, let's get back to what we were talking about. Why was Obama's mother taking Russian language classes in 1960? The height of communist antagonism toward the West, Stanley Ann Durham had no interest in becoming a diplomat. Obama recalled that when Lolo Santoro got a job with an American oil company in Indonesia, the family's standard of living improved considerably. They moved to a better house, and they bought a car, they had the TV, they even had a record player. But instead of being pleased, instead of being overjoyed with such riches and good fortune, no, 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 no. Is Mays here? I really wish that she, I'd love for her to come in and deal with this situation. Because it's an interesting topic, because we're getting into, and all the rest of the week, we're going to be getting into the Obama administration. Not the Obama administration, but Mr. Obama himself, President Obama himself, his family, his friends. We're going to go back and we're going to dig deep. We're going to dig deep right here. And we're going to get all the facts out. And we're going to talk about it. So, apparently, Stanley was not happy with all these fine riches. No, 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 no. It should have been pleased, Stanley. It should have pleased her. Obama, Stanley Durham Obama Santoro's Marxist consciousness was apparently offended. Mays has a crush on Doc. You're throwing me off my game here. You're throwing me off my topic here with that kind of talk. Oh, my God. Starting to break out into a sweat over here. And I got the air on. looking back, Obama writes in his first autobiography, Dreams of My Father, I'm not sure that Lolo ever fully understood what my mother was going through during those years. Why the things he was working so hard to provide for her seemed only to increase the distance between them. As if there was something normal, something right and logical about his mother's reaction. Imagine that. Lolo was simply making money and being a provider. And Stan Stan was all, you know, where does all this come from? We're supposed to be living off the land. We're communists. We're socialists. We're not supposed to have all these riches. A car? That's what you've got feet for. Food on the table? A record player? That's what that ox is out back. That's what that's for. That's why we got those chickens. So she was not pleased. Stanley was not pleased that Lolo was actually making some money, a capitalist, and providing for her and his stepson. Apparently, no one clued Lolo into clued Lolo into the white guilt thing, middle class guilt, and the agony of a socialist consciousness that had that Obama and Stanley had been raised in. Obama recalled later that his mother argued with Lolo Isetoro over her refusal to go to dinner parties at the oil company. Obama describes these as dinner parties from hell, choked with crude, boorish, ugly Americans. Quote, American businessmen from Texas and Louisiana would slap Lolo's back and boast about the palms they had greased to obtain the new offshore drilling rights, while their wives complained to my mother, this is Obama talking, about the quality of Indonesian help. Lolo asked Stanley Ann to consider how it would look for him to go alone and reminded her that these were her own people. So are we getting a sense, an idea of why Barack Obama has this not-so-happy crush, not a good deal with the oil companies now? Is it coming into focus now? Those fat cats? Those damn private jet owners? How dare they? And when Obama says to you that at some point he believes you've made enough money, and then when Obama says he speaks to how much money we, those of us who produce, should be allowed to keep, is it coming into focus now? I'd like to ask that question. Is it coming into focus now, knowing what you know now? Because what I'm relaying to you is Obama's own words, not my opinion. I'm not reading between the lines here. So is it coming into focus now for anyone? Now, Obama, Lolo, not Stanley, is remembered as saying that those were not her people. Yet that was far from the picture Obama painted of her as he ran for president. He went on to say, and I quote, "My mother, whose parents were non-practicing Baptists and Methodists," end quote. And said Obama during the campaign, quote, "was one of the most spiritual souls I ever knew. She believed that people were all basically the same under their skin, that bigotry of any sort was wrong, and that the goal was then to treat everybody as unique individuals, except those nasty oil folks, those people who had refrigerators and cars and record players and were making money. Damn those folks." Stanley was beside herself with grief, with disgust. Stanley was disgusted that there were people out there actually making money. Oh, yeah. And buying fridges and record players and cars with that money, those ill-gotten gains. That's right. Poor Stanley, God rest her soul. What does her son think of all this? Let me give you an example of how children can be taught. Children can be taught to hate. They can be taught bigotry. I remember when I saw a cat run across the street. I was standing with my son Nicholas, and then he was 4 years old, or five. And I said to Nick, as the cat ran across the street, "Nick, cats are evil. I don't like cats." Nick, a couple of days later, with his mom, went over to visit some of her friends. One of her friends had a cat. Nick was heard saying, "Cats are evil. My dad says cats are evil." It was as if he actually believed it. All you got to do is say it. They're impressionable little things. So what do you think Barack Obama was thinking when Stanley was expressing her disgust and distaste for people actually owning things? Cars and record players and refrigerators. And making that dirty old filthy money. Damn them. Stanley must have been thinking. He said nothing about his mama's leftism and Marxism. He said nothing about that during the campaign. Yet this was the way in which young Barack Obama grew up. And this was the early air he breathed, the early intellectual food he feasted upon. He's called his mother, and I quote, "the dominant figure in my formative years. The value she taught me continue to be my touchstone when it comes to how I go about the world of politics." That's a direct quote. Now, certainly he's maintained and strengthened associations that his mother made in those years. One, Morgan Reynolds, a professor emeritus at Texas A&M University and former chief economist for the Department of Labor. Hey, Antoinette, sorry to see you go. Antoinette's got to run. Hey, I tell you what. Now, Texas A&M, Morgan Reynolds, a professor emeritus at Texas A&M University and former chief economist for the Department of Labor, reports that Peter Gaynor, I'm sorry, I mispronounced his name. We love Mays. Yes, come on in, Mays. If her husband will let her. Peter Geithner oversaw the microfinance programs developed in Indonesia by Ann Durham Sotoro, Barack Obama's mama. Barack Obama appointed Peter Geithner's son, Timothy Geithner, as Secretary of the Treasury. Once in Hawaii, Obama's radical associations continued. He went to Sunday school at the First Unitarian Church of Honolulu, a highly publicized church that aligned during the 1970s with the radical group Students for a Democrat Society, or SDS, a group in which a future Obama comrade played a significant role. His name, Bill Ayers. That's right. Now, Frank Marshall Davis in Dreams of My Father, Frank Marshall Davis is a figure that we'll touch on briefly. In Dreams of My Father, Obama writes affectionately about Frank. That's who he called. He called him Frank, whose full name he never gives in Dreams of My Father. Now, during the 2008 campaign, the Obama camp acknowledged that Frank was a poet, a journalist, an activist, and his name was Frank Marshall Davis. Davis was yet another communist, indeed a Communist Party member, according to Gerald Horn, a contributing editor and for the Communist Party. USA Magazine Political Affairs writes that Davis lived in the same place as Obama and his family, but not always at the same time. Davis was born in Kansas and spent a good deal of his adult life in Chicago before decamping to Honolulu in 1948 at the suggestion of his good friend, Paul Robeson. Robeson, of course, was another communist. Once in Hawaii, Horn explained that Davis eventually befriended another family, a Euro-American family that had migrated to Honolulu from Kansas, and a young woman from that family eventually had a child with a young student from Kenya. Are you digging it? Are you digging it? Can you dig it? I wish I had a clip of that. And all the dots are being connected right here and now. The young student from Kenya, East Africa, who goes by the name of Barack Obama, who retraced the steps of Davis, eventually decamped to Chicago. Oh, my God. Maya Santoro, Obama's half-sister, recalled that her grandfather, Stanley Durham, encouraged Davis and Obama to form a bond regarding Davis as a point connection, a bridge, if you will, to a larger African-American experience for my brother. So what we have here, a whole bushel of damned communists and socialists all getting together. Now, East Coast writes in the chat room, not all communists are bad. No, they're not. Not all of them. As, you know, I guess. But when you're a communist or a socialist and you're running the country, when the country is rooted in capitalism and free will and, you know, all that messy stuff, that's a bad thing. That's not good. No. All right. So in his book, Davis describes how he and his wife kind of hung out with a 13-year-old girl named Anne. He portrayed this as a favor to the girl. And this pedophile and child rapist was an overwhelming and warmly remembered influence. He bedded the 13-year-old girl, Stanley Ann Durham. So Barack Obama, Barack's dad, is alleged to be a pedophile, having sex with the young 13-year-old Stanley Ann Durham. Grown man. So now, it's all sounding kind of sordid now, isn't it? So while I go wash my mouth out with soap and puke, you all stay right here. I'll be right back.
I remember America. Sure, you can still find it on a map, but nobody older than 20 thinks this is America. Even if coordinates are the same, we've lost our compass. You don't have a direction without reference, a true north. For America, it was liberty. When we lost the love of liberty, our understanding of liberty, it was just a matter of time before the rest of it was lost. Some think it started when the auto companies were nationalized, or the police state to control the internet. Or when certain companies couldn't fail because their relationship with politicians made them too big to fail, and the rest of us, without political influence, were too small to succeed. Sure, that all happened pretty quickly, over just a couple of years, but liberty had been gradually devolving for decades. Some of the more astute, like Ayn Rand, saw it about 50 years before others. She warned us, but people didn't believe it could happen here until it did. Laws had been used to loot productive individuals and businesses, but in the new millennium, under Bush and Obama, graft, corruption, and crony capitalism were no longer hidden behind closed doors. The looters and their laws came out of hiding like rabid animals that were no longer afraid of humans. It was brought into the spotlight when and it was celebrated as enlightened economic policy. Ayn Rand asked the question in Atlas Shrugged that the rest of us were asking 60 years later. Which failing financial institution will the administration pluck from the flames of crisis, and which will it let roast? Which market or investment technique will the regulators bless, and which, in a capricious change of rules, will it condemn or outlaw? As John Galt said in his radio address,
you decided you had a right to your wages, but we had no right to our profits. You called it selfish and cruel that men should trade value for value. But you've now established an unselfish society where they trade extortion for extortion.
People who had never produced or managed anything tried to manage every aspect of our lives, and they brought production to a standstill. And eventually, they decided to micromanage the food supply in the name of fairness and safety. And we all know what happened then. Fiction can be a powerful influence, for good or bad. It's too bad more people didn't read Atlas Shrugged. They might have realized where this was heading.
Atlas is shrugging right now. You're on the C. Robert Jones Conservative Report. The call-in number is 347-884-8500. Now, Mr. Davis seemed to have instructed young Barack Obama in leftism and radical grievance mongering. Horn recalls that in Dreams of My Father, Obama speaks warmly about an older black poet. He identifies simply as Frank as being a decisive influence in helping him define his present identity as an African American. A people who have been the least anti-communist and the most left-leaning of any constituency in this nation. From the looks of his portrayal in Dreams of My Father, Frank Marshall Davis was a principal influence on the race baiting and polarization that Barack Obama would make a centerpiece of this presidency. Now, this is no surprise. Dreams of My Father is itself a political manifesto cast in a first-person narrative in order to make the ideologies and internationalism, socialism, and race hate palatable to left-leaning Americans. Are we starting to get the point here? Are we starting to get to the meat of the matter? Because what we're doing tonight, folks, is we're getting deep into the psyche of Barack Hussein Obama, and I am recounting for you through my research all this week and last week what folks are saying about Barack Obama, who were part of his formative years. I am quoting from Dreams of My Father. I am quoting from The Case Against Barack Obama. I am also quoting from the Manchurian President, and a couple of other research items that I've uncovered. So I'm quoting directly. I have not yet injected my opinions, and that'll come later, perhaps another show. But right now we're gonna get to the facts here. We're gonna talk about facts the rest of the show, the next 5 minutes. Now, Obama and Islam. One of the most particular lessons of the presidential campaign of 2008 was that you could disparage someone merely by saying his name. During the campaign of 2008, to speak of Barack Obama's Muslim roots and ties suddenly became akin to disparaging and insulting him, and also engaging in bigotry and innuendo. Now, I wrote about these links early on, and for doing so, I myself was called a bigot, a racist, and an Islamophobe. I can't even say that. Did you hear me try to say it? An Islamophobe. I finally got it out. I'm as black as Barack Obama. And yet I, your humble host, C. Robert Jones, was called names. Racist, bigot, sellout, don't know my history, and a whole bunch of other stuff. Now, Obama went to extraordinary measures to obfuscate his Muslim background. The more proof that bloggers like me produced, the more we were marginalized. So secretive was Obama that he refused to release his long-form birth certificate for a long time, just until just recently. His school records? No. His thesis? No. His school records, his passport on which he traveled as a teen, the list is long and indistinguished and distinguished altogether. Barack Hussein Obama has been hiding who Barack Hussein Obama is for a very long time. Now, we've got just about 3 minutes left. I want to get my guy Craig in here briefly, and then we're going to wrap it up for the night. But we'll come back tomorrow, and we'll get more in-depth, in detail, about who our president really is and what his influences were as a child growing up, and why and how it all matches up to what's happening today. Craig, you're on with the C. Robert Jones Conservative Report.
Hey, how are we doing, Doc?
All is well, my man.
All
right. How are you?
Good. Good topic. I want to take due to the sort of the side conversation going on in the chat. I wanted to take a minute just to address that we have got to stop allowing this message that corporations are our enemies.
Mm-hmm.
There are, without a doubt, CEOs that have utilized their positions within a corporation to be destructive. However, corporations are not evil. They do not want you to be poor, people. They do not. They want you to flourish, because if you are not flourishing, you are not gainfully employed, you do not have money in your pocket, you cannot buy the goods and services that corporations want to sell. Okay? There is obviously some questionable relationships through lobbying, but if you remove lobbying, you not only remove the corporate lobbyists, you remove lobbyists that are there for you, i.e. Freedom Works and other organizations like that. Lobbying is a pivotal part of a free market capitalist republic that we are. You have got to have liaisons between us and our elected officials. So lobbying is not evil in and of itself. There are evil immoral happenings, obviously, but that happens throughout humanity.
All right.
So,
well, now
we
have got to wrap it up.
Right.
East Coast is saying, just like we're focusing too much on individuals. Individuals make up companies, corporations, nations, politics. The president of the United States is an individual, East Coast, and he happens to be running this once great country of ours. It's important to focus on individuals. Individuals make up the collective. I am an individual, yet I own stock in Microsoft, in a lot of GE, and a whole other whole host of big businesses and companies. Individuals are what we should be focusing on, not a nameless, faceless corporation. Thank you all for being here.
Well,
I appreciate everybody coming in. Craig, Billy, C, F, G, A, East Coast, Beach Bomb, Dessler when he was here, Antoinette, Liz, first time seeing Liz in the room, Gunslinger, everybody, love you. Hey, thank you for listening. Please come back tomorrow, because we're going to pick up where we left off. We did not have this show on long enough. It was supposed to be 90 minutes, but it went short for some reason. Wonderful. Have a good night. Thank you all for being here. All right.
And the dream. Mm-hmm. Wait.
Yeah.
Yeah, what's the matter?
Huh?
What's the matter?
Nothing, I'm just working.